Today's episode comes not from Silicon Valley, but from Mongolia. Population? 3.2 million. The capital? Ulaanbaatar. Top industry? Mining, like copper, coal, oil, and gold. Neighbor countries? China to the south and Russia to the north. The first time Asia Batbold ever saw the ocean was when she was at the University of Miami. Her 100-degree beach days in Florida were just a bit different than her typical -25-degree winter days in her home country of landlocked Mongolia. And after graduating from Miami in 2015, she found herself soon after as a consultant in Germany, where on a walk in Berlin, came across a store selling $2,000 cashmere sweaters. From there, a light bulb went off. Compete against European cashmere with Mongolian yak.
Maybe alternative to cashmere could be sheep, there could be camel, there could be yak. And yak, I thought like, oh, not a lot of people know about yak here in Europe.
But when Asia returned to her home country to make a higher quality, more affordable sweater using yak wool, the questions she got from suppliers and yak herders weren't how much will you pay or how much yak wool do you need? Instead,
oh, so you're like, you worked at these big companies in Europe and the US, and how can my daughter do that? You know, how can my son do that? Like, but you did.
And so there it was. Asia and her friends, they decided to build an online platform that would empower Mongolian students to access study abroad opportunities and English language courses. And this was back in 2019. Now, less than 2 years later, Asia is co-founder and COO of the rapidly growing Tomyo, meaning formula in Mongolian, which with nearly 200,000 users, 800 instructors, and a seven-figure seed valuation, has become the largest e-learning platform in all of Mongolia. But to go from yak wool to taking on the world, literally, of education, well, it's a story only Asia can tell. I'm David Zubinski.
And I'm Asia Batbold.
And this is not from Silicon Valley. Stories of trial and triumph from founders in emerging and frontier economies. Asia, I think of Mongolia and I naively, perhaps ignorantly, think of sheep and coal and lots of land. Tell me a bit about where you grew up.
So growing up in Mongolia, I come from the countryside, actually not the Ulaanbaatar, the capital city where 1 million people live. And the total population of Mongolia is 3 million. So, you know, I come from a town of less than 100,000 people. I think it was at the time around like 50,000 people. And it was a very small town. And both my parents worked for this mining company, and I got very lucky. There was one private school in my town, and they taught English, you know. So I got into that private school, and that's how my life got very lucky.
And so what is it that you mean by lucky, that you were able to enroll in a private school and learn English? Do the public schools in Mongolia, do they not teach English?
Public schools do teach English, but it's very limited. It's not the same quality. And the public schools are amazing, but they do not teach you English as well, right? They teach the local curriculum very well, but you don't get to have global access like I did. And in the total like country, we have 1,000 public schools probably, and then like only 20 or 30 private schools. So that's just like narrows down your chance of becoming, like world-class education in a way.
So this vast majority of Mongolian high school students that graduate with weaker English speaking skills, what opportunities do they have when they graduate?
Yeah, so most of the youth now goes to university here locally in Mongolia, but the employment rate is very low. Mongolian big industries are known as the mining or cashmere, kind of the agriculture. And those are the two biggest industries, you know. And then most youth do not want to go to mining or agriculture. They want to go into high tech. And I think that kind of like employment opportunities are very limited. So it's kind of a funny situation where you graduate from university, but have to work as a cashier in shops because you don't want to just go to the mining or agriculture, right?
Right. And so you were one of the very few Mongolians to graduate high school with English proficiency. And of all the places to go for college, Asia, you decided South Beach. Why is that?
The reason I also applied to university in Miami was we're a landlocked country. I never seen an ocean in my life. I never seen what this sea, like this beautiful beach is, you know? So going to Florida was like life changing. Not only that, I mean, I was just so amazed how rich people were, you know? And how much like stuff they had, like their houses were huge. I mean, it was just, they had so much waste and it was just crazy.
Yeah, waste, it's an interesting one. I think many believe there's a major problem with almost this blind consumerism in the States. The waste that you saw in Miami, it must have been quite a contrast to a more, I suppose, minimalistic way of life you had growing up, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we just had the bare necessities. I had PC when I was the 10th grade, I think. My family just bought the first PC. So coming from there to like just the, you know, like this party town, Miami, it was the richest of the states, you know, people were there. And sports cars and just like, it was eye-opening. And I was just like, wow, these people like, they lived the life with these amazing opportunities and kind of like the tools that they can use to improve the world, right? And and then you adapt really quickly. That's the fun part of it. Like coming from like you have nothing, but then you get like accustomed to the easy, how convenient everything are in the States.
Well, I'm sure you became accustomed, but as a small town girl from rural Mongolia to one of the party capitals of the world, there must have been a few other things that you were shocked by.
I would say, I think the first thing that shocked me was the credit card system, right? I mean, I was a student international. I didn't have money, but they give me a credit card with like $500 on it. And I was just like, you just give me for free. Like, yeah. And then like, I can use it for nothing. Like I didn't earn this $500, but just spend it, right? And then you can pay it later. And that like blew my mind. And I mean, I learned later on, like everything they own is on the credit card.
Wait, sorry, hold up. Who gave you this credit card?
Oh, it was just the bank gave me as a student, being a student at the university, they give you just these credit cards with the money on it you can spend. I don't know if I paid it back, but they just gave me without any, like, you know, I didn't earn it.
Right. So you not earning this $500 ahead of time was weird for you. Why is that? High school and college kids aren't running around Mongolia with Amex and platinum credit cards?
Here in Mongolia, it's the opposite way. Like you earn your money first, you save like 20 years to buy your first apartment. You save a lot of money. You need to have a debit and then you can spend it later on. So I think that was a very kind of like counterintuitive system for me to understand. But in a way that also like enabled you, like that $500 made huge difference in my life, right? Like I'm buying like my first laptop there with this credit card. Otherwise, I would have to maybe like work part-time and save, you know, 5 months to just being able to buy a laptop. So I think that just gives you the tool to like, if you want something, you can have the chance to do it and fail at it. You know, that's the beauty of the state's credit card system is, I think.
And so 4 years later, Aja graduated University of Miami with accolades and post-grad landed consulting roles with McKinsey in both Berlin and Prague. But it was a walk down the street in Berlin one afternoon looking at cashmere sweaters when Aja realized...
Oh, they were so expensive. I mean, I that was a moment that changed my life too. Like that, if I had not went to that luxury shop in Berlin and looked at the tag of that cashmere sweater and it said like 2,000 euros or something, right? And I thought it was 200 euros because that's usually like, you know, that's already like twice, like three times more expensive than what Kashmir costs in Mongolia. So I couldn't believe my eyes. There was like extra zero on that tag, $2,000 better.
Okay. And so naturally the entrepreneur in you sees a Kashmir sweater selling for more than 10 times what it should be. And then?
And then I was like, okay, so we already, like, Mongolia, we have so much Kashmir. I think we're the second biggest exporter of Kashmir in the world after China. But yet we're still not getting the value that it deserves. We're just exporting it, like, you know, like at least 100 times cheaper than that sweater costs.
Right. And so even though it was the herder that did all the work to get the Kashmir, it's the Berlin retailer that sees the ridiculous margin.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as the herder in the countryside, who I can relate to, are probably not getting anything off that $2,000, right? So that's when I was like, okay, there's a huge gap in the value chain, the supply chain of this Kashmir industry. But then at the same time, I was like, Kashmir is not so environmentally friendly. I mean, we have so much like...
Sorry, you'll have to forgive my lack of agricultural knowledge here. Why is it that Kashmir from goats isn't environmentally friendly?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So goats, they're just tiny animals, but they do destroy the roots of the grass they eat. So the next year on that grassland they herd, you're not going to have so much grass. Versus the other animals like the sheep, camels, or yak, they do not destroy the roots of the grass. So the next year, it's still like green land, same way.
Okay, and so to make a more sustainable, affordable Kashmir, you were down to sheep, camels, or yak, and you chose yak.
Absolutely. So yak is a very interesting exotic animal here in Mongolia we have, and they already have like the wool, which is very similar to Kashmir. So I just wanted to export that wool and kind of like see if there could be a value competitive to Kashmir. And that's when I started Yakmir. And it was really fun because I just kind of like put the concept out there on a Kickstarter and then said, hey, Yakmir is much better in terms of quality, much warmer, and also better environmentally than compared to Kashmir. Would you be interested to own in like a Yakmir sweater? And a lot of people responded, and I raised, I think, the first campaign over 20,000 or 30,000 euros. And that's when I was like, okay, maybe I could like quit my full-time consulting job and actually try and give it a go, because see, people are interested, you know?
And so you left McKinsey to sell yak wool.
Right.
And it might sound crazy, but Aja was onto something. So the next step? Head back home to Mongolia after more than a decade away in the U.S. and Europe and begin speaking to local yak herders to lock down supply. The only issue, these herders, they didn't want to speak yak.
When I was in the countryside, I ran into a lot of people and they were just like not interested. I was pitching them the idea, hey, I'm interested in your yaks. I'm interested in buying the wool in the next 5 years, you know, so let's make a business out of it. And I'm just like, well, like, yeah, you know, they can learn English, they can do it and that, but like, how's your yak? And they were just like, never stop, like, you know, they question me about my education. They wanted the same opportunities for their kids.
So what'd you do?
So me and my co-founders, we were longtime friends. So they already worked at IBM, Amazon, Dell. They come from very technical background. And one of my co-founder and we were just talking about how I can make this Yakmir work. And I told them the stories about how all these herders were asking me how to send their kids away to global schools, right? And he was like, oh, I get questions, same thing. Whenever I'm pitching my like ideas, all the people ask me about my experience of going abroad. So we were just like, okay, so you come from technical background, you can build an app. We can just maybe do this like mentorship thing where we answer all the questions on the app. So we just, if somebody asks, we'll just tell them like, you know, go on the app and there's already all these questions like already asked and everything there. So we want to have built an app for ourselves as a way to just give back to our community.
Okay, so you'd build a forum or a Q&A of sorts, so you could just send a link on to folks who had asked about how and where and why you and your friends studied and worked abroad. What happened next?
And then immediately after that, I mean, like, there were people, like, it was just more than, like, what we expected. We got, like, 1,000 registered users on before we actually launched the application. We just said it on our Facebook, hey, we're doing this. You know, if people want to test our application, it's not on the App Store yet, but it's on a test flight, and we want to test it if this is a good user experience for the users. And there were like thousands of people registered. And that's when I was like, okay, so we need to be, maybe we can monetize this. Maybe this could be a business, you know? So that's when we started, okay, just more than answering questions as a Q&A, we can add video courses. We can teach English. We can show them how the Harvard campus looks like or how the Columbia campus looks like. We can show them, we can take them like through these vlog journeys and just, you know, like inspire them in more visual ways. And that's when we started just adding more features to this app, right? First of all, it was just like discussion forum. And then it was just mentorship, conferencing. And then it was a video conferencing, video courses. And now we have 20 plus features.
Right. So your first pivot, Yakwol to online forum to help Mongolian students learn about studying and working abroad. The second pivot, a full-fledged app whereby Mongolian students could do anything from learn English to take a virtual tour of the Harvard campus. Did you have technical know-how to develop this platform?
No, I'm the only non-technical founder in the team. So everybody else did the technical parts and I was the one screaming, hey, we don't have money. How long are we going to do this? are we able to monetize this? Hey, why are we even wasting our time on this? You know, so I was the only one who was just kind of like thinking about the business side of things.
So how'd you keep things going?
Yes. So initially, our founders, we put them out like some money from our pockets. And that was just as a way to like, okay, you know, like at least we have 5 months to test this project. And we already just hired the first 2-3 developers. And in 7 months, actually we bootstrapped. So we were pretty like confident. And then we just started demoing this like mock-up application we built to kind of like existing schools here. And one of the school kind of founder were very intrigued by the idea. And then she invested in us as an angel investment. You know, she knew kind of the traditional school system needs to digitize as well. So what she was thinking was maybe she could use this application for her schools as a way to also like do this hybrid schooling approach.
And you had a live working product at that time?
It was just a mock-up. It didn't really work. It was just kind of like screens, like, hey, this is how it's going to look like. But, you know, we're eventually going to make the back end to work. So when you click on it, it's going to work. You know, so that was our pitch. And she kind of just like believed in us, which is amazing.
How much did she invest?
She gave us like $150,000. And that got us like another year.
150 grand? That's a lot for an angel round. What'd you do with the money?
We hired more developers. We had more people working on the idea. And funny story. So we built the application. It started working, right? And we needed like a real content on the platform because without the content, we cannot launch. So that's when we were struggling. Hey, we like reached out to all these like language centers. Hey, do you want to like, you know, upload your content to our app? And they were just like, no, we're okay. So we were just asking our friends, hey, you know English, why don't you teach just like the alphabet, you know? And then we started asking our friends, you know Japanese, why don't you just teach like, you know, the beginner kind of grammar? And then they did. And our initial courses were really bad, kind of like just non-expert courses, but they still like worked.
Wait, what? You launched the app without any formal experienced instructors? What were you guys teaching?
Exactly. So one of our co-founders, he did pronunciation course and he like kind of like, you know, always corrects us when we speak English and maybe like, you know, like don't say it the right way. He always corrects us. So we kind of like asked him, hey, you're so good at pronunciation. Why don't you teach that? And he did, you know, so that course is still out there.
it's unbelievable. So a bunch of non-educators being the educators on an ed tech app. Why do you think, Aja, other teachers and language centers in Mongolia were so reluctant to join your platform at the start?
They were already like doing pretty okay. As I told you before, we have very few like private language centers, and they're kind of like already monetized, and on the demand is huge. So for them, it was just like it was another work, and they didn't really believe in, you know, if they could make money on it. Like, why would we even just go there? It was just kind of not worth it for them.
Okay, so you and your co-founders are offering, for example, English pronunciation courses. And then
that's when it got started, like having more traction than we anticipated. And then we needed more money to kind of like make it more usable to people, and kind of also like hire a content team, because initially we didn't want to hire a content team because we thought, you know, people will come and they'll use it. We're a technology company, we're a platform. But then, you know, there were so many people and they were demanding us like, okay, why don't you upload the next course? What else is on your platform? You know, they were really demanding us, these users. So we needed to hire like 10 people on our content side. And then now we become like a tech and content team. So the content team were just like, you know, asking all these like teachers out there, hey, do you have a content? Do you want to teach? And they were like, yes, we want to teach, but we don't know how to record the video. So we had to create a production team and create a studio and record their courses so we can upload it to the platform. So now we grow from like 5 people to like 15, 20 people in less than like a couple of months, I think. By July, we had 20-something people. We launched in April. In July, we grew from like 5 to 25 people.
Right. So July 2019, you're getting some additional content on the Tomio platform. How are things looking financially?
So we had huge, good traction. And then we were running out of money that we raised with the angel investor. At this point, we were not making money. We were just bleeding because we were like hiring content people. We bought like expensive. This was in July, you know, so we only had like 2 months left of a runway, and we already hired this 25 something people and we didn't have money. So I was freaking out. I was just like, okay, so are we going to like fire all these people? Like, what are we going to do? Like, I mean, the traction is amazing. We have so much people interested in the app, but we're not making money. So I had to go out there and I met, I think, like 20 plus investors potentially here in Mongolia. And because we were raising like seed round, so it was quite substantial money for Mongolian standard. And I talked to 20 something plus the top companies and corporations here, and only like 5 of them were barely interested in the idea. And then out of those 5, we secured 1, and then that kind of like gave us another 1 year runway.
Why do you think so many investors were so reluctant to invest? Was it the sector, or maybe how early you guys were in your company life cycle?
I think it was a combination of both. Me and my co-founder, he comes from a technical background and I come from business background. And to their eyes, we were just kind of like 2 outsiders who recently came back to Mongolia and they didn't know about the local markets. And this girl, she's crazy. She doesn't know what she's talking about because she's talking big numbers, right? She's talking global because no Mongolian kind of like startup, let alone like company, has been successful at competing at the global stage. So for them saying like, oh, like we're gonna, you know, like hit the Mongolian market, we're gonna have 100,000 users here in Mongolia from youth, which is your target market, you know, we're gonna have all these users, and then we're gonna go to Philippines, we're gonna go to Sri Lanka, and they were just like, okay, you lost me at, you know, Philippines, Sri Lanka, because that's just something. It's just unimaginable, I think, for them, right? And then it also, technology is very new. I mean, you're talking about technology company and the valuation is the way you evaluate like technology company is crazy. So to them, you're not cash positive and you're asking this much money on what premises?
And most of these Mongolian investors, they probably weren't used to a woman founder. How was that experience for you?
Yeah. So I think it's been really funny experience. Most of them would just kind of like not talk to me, but would talk to our CTO or kind of like our tech people. And I'm just like, I'm the one who knows the numbers. You should ask me, you know? So that's been a very funny experience. I was young compared to my co-founder. So I think to their eyes, like, okay, he probably knows most of the things and she's just probably, I don't know, what am I doing in that meeting, right?
Okay, well, nonetheless, you did close the seed round. How much did you raise?
So on the seed round, we raised $350,000. So together with the first angel investment, now we raised $500K.
That's a lot of money. And what valuation was the seed investment?
So we got like around $4 million in valuation.
A $4 million valuation, that's really good for an edtech company that started its journey without any professional teachers on its platform. And remind me, Aja, back at the launch in May of 2020, a year ago, how many users did you have?
In May, we had, just because we launched, so we just only had like 1,000 users or so.
And now, 1 year later?
Now we have 800 plus educators and we have 170,000 users. So we grew from 1,000 to 170,000 users in a year exactly now.
What? So you grew from 1,000 to 170,000 in 1 year? Did you and your co-founders expect a year ago that you'd see that type of growth?
It was a funny story. We kind of like all bet. We were 20 people and we all bet how many people we were going to have on the day of launch. So that's May 14th. And we just said like, oh, maybe 100. And the most, our CTO said like, you know, he's very positive. He's very like, you know, optimistic person. And then he said, oh, we're going to have 280 people. And then same day we launched, we had more than 1,000 people. So it was 1,300 people. So kind of like that gave us kind of like the initial reaction. Oh, this could be something, you know, on day one, we knew this could be something big.
I mean, what's your total addressable market? I'm sure you've got nearly every eligible student in Mongolia using Tomio.
Our like total addressable market out of this 3 million was only just like, you know, 300,000 people at most. And of that, we already captured 170,000. So we're already like 50% or plus penetrated in our local market.
Okay, so nearly 200,000 users. And you mentioned now you've got 800 instructors. That's an achievement, right? From letting just about anyone teach to having nearly 1,000 professionals on the platform. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So now we have so much request of people trying to get on our platform. We're not able to enable them all because we have guidelines and we have standards for our video courses. You know, initially we had no standards, obviously, because I was teaching pronunciation. My, you know, co-founders were teaching anything. But now we do have a standard because there's so much content and so much kind of like expertise people are trying to share with each other. And I think that's education is becoming more accessible and kind of like more borderless, more out of box in that way. You don't need a certificate. You don't need a graduation diploma. As long as you have the skills, I think you can, you know, like do your own thing. You can work for anybody or you can work globally. And I think that's the beauty of it. I think the education is changing. The employment, the way people used to work are changing. So, I mean, it's very exciting time for us.
And do you keep your teachers and instructors incentivized? Are they paid?
Absolutely. So we tried to look into kind of like the Netflix and YouTubes of the world, like how the content creators were rewarded for their content. And we kind of like modeling after YouTube, which is, you know, if your content is performing very well, if you have a lot of views, quality views, then we're sharing our revenue with these content creators. So this is a very fair model because we're tracking, first of all, anybody can get revenue as long as your content is applicable and relatable to the users and users are watching it a lot of times. That means it's a good content, right? So revenue share model, this is very much merit-based and then it incentivizes our educators to actually create something more meaningful in a short period of time without, you know, trying to just like rumble over things.
And how about the business model for your 170,000 students using the app? What's the cost for a student to use the Tomio app?
So right now it costs less than 30 cents a day. We do have like this monthly subscription, which works best. So compared to like a traditional language center here in, say, English course, for 1 month, it costs you around like $90 in USD. And ours, like annual subscription is around that price. So we wanted to make sure we can price at a point where most of the people can have access to, especially who we're targeting, which is not the city people, but more the remote parts of Mongolian people.
Right. And that's really the added value Tomyo brings, I think. Aside from making private education more affordable, it allows rural Mongolians to access courses they wouldn't have otherwise, because their small towns are often neglected by the country's private instruction institutions, right?
Exactly. And you have more than 8 languages, 800 plus educators. We have 10,000, I think now we have 15,000 hours of video courses on our application. And we have mentors. I mean, we have tests and quizzes. We developed a lot of features. So I think it's a very nice kind of like world to explore. It literally is a world to explore for anybody who usually do not have that kind of access.
And Asia, this world that you've created for Mongolian students to explore, do you have any favorite stories from your Tomyo users?
Oh, there's this one. I think that was the phone call, which was kind of like this angry girl. She called our customer service, and she comes from like, I come from countryside, but her countryside is even smaller than my countryside town, right? And she comes from like 800 kilometers away from the city. She called us and she said like, you know, when is this next Japanese course is going to be uploaded? I've been waiting for more than 2 weeks, and you guys are not just updating your contents. And we were just like, we already have so many like Japanese courses on our app, and we don't think, you know, people are watching Japanese. And she was just like, no, I already passed like to advanced level, and I need the next level courses. And there's no other way for me to learn this other than, you know, using your app, because in her town, yeah, I mean, yet alone, there's no English course. So there cannot be Japanese course, you know, training centers, language centers like that. So she was just like, you know, she was furious, but at the same time, it was a very, I mean, you know, like a funny kind of positive call for us.
Yeah, I think you said it best that in her small town, she wouldn't be able to learn English. But here she is from home in rural Mongolia, becoming fluent in Japanese. Tomyo has let her find a new passion, but more importantly, help her gain an incredible skill.
I know. How amazing is that? You know, this like, I should pitch this to a Japanese investor. So I should bring her on, you know, to the pitch meetings.
Okay, so on that topic, meeting new investors. Asia, what's next? You've gone from 1,000 users or so to now 170,000. So when we talk in May of 22, a year from now, where will Tomyo be?
That's very easy to answer, because we were just preparing for that answer for our YC application. And we already have, we're working with Idu Lanka Foundation in Sri Lanka. They do mentorship services. So they've been training for 4 years traditionally, but now because of COVID and everything, our solution is very much applicable to them, and they want to use our solution. And we're working with Clarendon College in Philippines. Also, same situation. They've been teaching, you know, 1,000 people, but COVID, everybody's at home. They don't know how to teach. They're using Facebook as a way to, you know, reach people. So we're working with them to create same kind of like mobile app platform so they can reach their people. So our goal is to reach Asia Pacific, enable same access, same technology. And by next year, end of next year, we're going to have 1 million users. And that's our goal. And I think we're very confident to do that. We're on track.
To be honest, I don't doubt that. And by doing that, you'd be empowering 1 million students across the world to have access to an education in nearly anything they want, regardless of where they live.
Absolutely. That's what we're trying to solve, you know, because I think location or kind of the financial barrier should not limit you to fulfill your full potential, right? And that's what we're trying to achieve.
So speaking of fulfilling one's potential, and you've clearly done just that, and then some, what is your message to other Mongolian entrepreneurs, Asia, hoping to have the same type of impacts that you've had?
Dream big. I mean, go global. I think that that's kind of like the only stage where you want to compete, you know? Mongolia is small. We're 3 million people. I mean, anything you can do is impactful here. But at the global scale, if you're like reaching and thinking and trying to compete at the global scale, I mean, nothing is limiting us. We could be a landlocked country here, like, you know, 1,000 miles away, but our technology is applicable. People used to be like, oh, like Silicon Valley startups. I mean, they're the most valued. They can do coding. But we can do coding here in Mongolia too, right? It's the same ground. I mean, the playing ground has been leveled equally now. So we can compete them.
And for young Mongolians to go global, Tomio is going to play a massive part in that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying to recruit our people, right? We're, first of all, empowering them to do so, and then we'll all go global together. I think that's beautiful.
That was Asia Batbold from Tomio on Not From Silicon Valley. Stay tuned as we interview founders from all around the world, from Nigeria to Mongolia, Egypt to Colombia, Kazakhstan to the Philippines, and everywhere in between. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.